For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
This morning we had a ceremony to celebrate the opening, formally celebrate the opening of this new practice place in Chicago. And the ceremony went really well. We enjoyed it. And but at the end, I invited some people. Or before the ceremony started, I invited the people to speak at the end of the ceremony. But I forgot at the end to invite them again. And they didn't step forward and say, "Hey, wait a minute, I have something to say here, young feller." So I wanted to invite them now to say something on the occasion of the opening of a new place of practice in the city. Would you, something you'd like to say?
What I was thinking of saying was just that the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate is a place to where we offer ourselves to Buddha, and it's a place where Buddha offers himself to Buddha or herself to Buddha, and it's a place where we offer ourselves to ourselves. So this practice is about enjoying ourselves, which is to say, our connection with all beings, and deeply expressing that. And Buddha's eyes were opened this morning, formally, ritually, and so there's new awareness there. Of course, his eyes were open always, but now they're really open. And so awareness itself is transformative. And we invite all of Chicago to come and join this practice.
And Nancy, is there something you could come up here and offer in celebration of this auspicious occasion?
Auspicious occasion. Thank you. Well, we spent the weekend sitting together and practicing together and listening to several really wonderful talks about giving and supporting each other. And I wanted to say something on behalf of our Sangha as the director. And what came to mind for me over the weekend was a koan or a teaching story. And so I quickly wrote down what seemed relevant to me. And so what I wanted to say was, many, many years ago, a long time ago, Feng Shui said, "If a single particle of dust is raised, the nation will flourish and the elders will furrow their brows. If no particle of dust is raised, the nation will perish and the elders will rest easy." And in response to that, Shui Du asked, "Are there any practitioners who will live together and die together?" And so today, this weekend, as we celebrate the raising of a whole cloud of dust, I say on behalf of our Sangha, may we always remember and remember this time that we've spent together, may we remember the importance and value of supporting each other's practice together.
Reverend Tayo, is there anything you'd like to offer?
Well, it was a little over 3.5 years ago. It was a cold, rainy morning when two men got into a car and started from Lake Merritt, Oakland, towards Chicago. It was a wonderful, wet, cold trip. And at one point, I was looked off to my left, and there were high mountains covered with snow. And when I looked off to my right, there was just the plains as far as you could see. And I realized we were driving the middle way. So as a result of this ceremony today, which really was wonderful, I realized again just starting to grow.
And excuse me, Rev, I just want to introduce for everyone Bob Rakulia. It's great that we're doing this here because for several years before we moved to the new space, January a year ago, we practiced here.
In this room?
No. Well, sometimes in this room, actually, yes. We moved around different rooms sometimes. Well, usually the room on the second floor. But anyway, Bob is the manager of this facility, and so this is our second home.
Can I make a quick consultation? Bob was just saying that there is a microphone available and wondered if that might be helpful. It's a little bit hard to hear in the back.
Would the people in the back please be so kind as to move closer? Like maybe up, no, I come up to the front, please, if you're willing. Yeah. Place right here, Nancy.
You don't have to tell me twice. Thank you.
Now, are you able to hear my voice now?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. I noticed in the announcement for this event, there was a quote, the announcement said something about living for the welfare of the world. So I think that's what the Zen is about. It's about living for the welfare of the whole world. I don't know if any Zen people would disagree with that, but that's what I think it's about. I also think that other schools of the Buddhist tradition also, I think, would maybe say that the practice of the Buddha way, is to live and practice for the welfare of the whole world and all living beings. So all living beings, you know, including the earth and the water and the sky. So I think that's pretty clear, and we've been talking about that all weekend. And so that's that. And then one might say, well, what should we do besides mention that? I have been, as I would guess you have been, through this life, often been deeply touched by expressions of compassion. But also recently, I was deeply touched by missed opportunities of expressing compassion. So, for example, I saw some examples of people who needed health care who weren't getting it. It really touched me that they didn't receive it. And then I saw examples of people who did need health care who got it, and I thought that was really wonderful that they got it. I wasn't exactly horrified by the stories of people not getting it, but sort of horrified. But more deeply touched, how sad it is that we have the facilities to give health care and somehow it's refused in some cases. People, there's something going on in their minds that they think they can't offer it. That it shouldn't be offered. That the request will be refused. It seems like that's a big mistake, to not give people that healthcare?
Healthcare doesn't necessarily take away people's suffering, but it puts them in a condition where they have a chance to, like, deal with it. You know, that they have enough healthcare to face their life. So I really felt like I wanted to work in some way as to support healthcare for everybody. It also occurred to me that I read an article in the New Yorker magazine, and it was about happiness, and it pointed out that in the survey they did, in the research they did, that generally speaking, the poor people that they interviewed were generally happier than the rich people. Was that what it said? I don't know if this really said that. Anyway, they were kind of surprised how upbeat the poor people were. But I think that also that was the poor people that weren't sick. Mm-hmm. I think if you're healthy and you're poor, you can kind of, like, you know, it's different than if you're sick and you're poor. And not only sick, but nobody's taking care of you. I think even if you're sick and somebody's taking care of you, whether you're poor or rich, you still feel like, well, at least somebody cares about me. So I was touched by that. And at the end of a movie I was watching about healthcare, it had this wonderful quote by a French man named Alexis de Tocqueville. And he said, "The greatness of America lies not in it being more enlightened than other nations, but in its ability to repair its faults." And that also is the greatness of human beings in general. It's not that we're more enlightened than dolphins, necessarily, or... And there's a movie about dolphins, too, by the way, called The Cove. It's a documentary which won the Academy Award this year, and it's about the whaling industry that's killing many, many dolphins. So that might be a good thing to watch too, the documentary called The Cove. But anyway, the great thing about humans, one of the great things about humans is that we have the ability to repair our faults. We have the ability to become aware of our shortcomings and address them and work on them. We can learn from our mistakes rather than ignore them and deny them. That's a great thing about us. And one mistake we could make as human beings, which we often do, is to think that other people are making mistakes and that they should repair them. That's not false, that other people are making mistakes and it would be good for them to repair them. It's just that that's not what's great about us. I noticed that we're really quite easy to notice other people are making mistakes. That's not our great thing. That's not the great thing about us, that we can see that other people are making mistakes. It's pretty good that we can notice that. It's kind of good that we can notice other people are making mistakes. That takes some intelligence to notice that. Quite a bit of intelligence, actually. But what's great is that we can notice our own. Because noticing other people's mistakes doesn't necessarily help them. Generally speaking, I don't see too much about how noticing other people's mistakes helps the other people or yourself. It can be a condition for helping other people if you notice they're making mistakes. But the main thing is that really helps other people. What really helps other people, and human beings can do this,
is for humans to notice their own mistakes. If we notice our own mistakes, that really helps other people. That protects other people. Is if we not just and not just notice them, but remember them and take care of them until we repair them. Like this morning, I made a mistake. I forgot to call on Reverend Tygan and Reverend Tayo and Reverend Nancy. Where is she? There she is. I forgot to call on them. That was a mistake. But I noticed it, and then I could make an effort to repair it. So I started by apologizing to them. And, you know, it didn't bother me at all to apologize to them. I'm a little bit bothered that I forgot to ask him, but I didn't mind asking, apologizing to them. So to notice other people's mistake is information which we have available to us, and usually human beings stop there. So we have a, and so other people's mistakes also are not really other people's mistakes. Everybody's mistakes are my mistakes. If I see other people making mistakes and I don't accept responsibility about it, I'm kind of talking down to them. So when I see other people's mistakes, this is my family's mistake. And I want to notice my mistake. My family's mistakes are my mistakes. And then I want to take my awareness of my mistakes to my family and say, I made some mistakes. A lot of times people come to me and say, what do I do if so-and-so does X? I say, well, it might be good to notice that you do it too. And then go to so-and-so and say, you know, I just did this terrible thing. You know, tell them, I mean, really sincerely notice that you did what they did. And go and tell them that, you know, you're really kind of sorry you did such and such. You know, like somebody, you know, is bad-mouthing somebody at the office, and you go up to this person and say, you know, I really feel bad because I've been bad-mouthing people around the office. And the person kind of goes, why is he telling me this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, but you should, you know, that person might say, oh, it's too bad that you do that. You should stop. And then you walk away, and then later they say, why did they tell me that? Huh, I wonder why they told me that. And then, you know, 1 week later, 6 weeks later, they go, oh. I do that. But they realize from the inside, than somebody telling you that you're bad. And if we notice our own shortcomings and are kind to them and aware of them, we cannot get stuck in them, and we can become free of them. And then we can show people how we do that, and they can watch that and learn that. So I'm happy also to hear that one night a week at the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, they have a night set aside for peace and environment concerns. And they have
once a month, but we're working on it.
Not once a week?
No.
But we could plan it.
Where's Laurie? Can you increase it to 1,000, please?
1,000.
Anyway, I thought we don't have a once a week time at Green Gulch Farm for dedicated to that. But not that I know of, but I would like to encourage people at Green Gulch to have that too, a night for that kind of event. But also, when Laurie told me about it, she said sometimes there's not a speaker for that night. So then they sit, then they do meditation. But our meditation is actually a meditation on peace and environmental concerns. That's what our meditation is. It's about concern for the environment. We sit in meditation, we sit quietly, and we just open our concern to the environment. The environment means the universe. It means the whole planet. It means the whole city. And we open to the peace of So that is our practice. But sometimes you don't have a speaker. But we always do that. But it's nice to have a night when you say, what we're doing here is we're sitting together as a community, meditating on the environment and peace. And tonight we don't have a speaker, so we're all just going to look inwardly and open to this practice. But that's the name of the practice tonight. And another night, something else, you know, like tonight's meeting is about meditating on our own shortcomings. We aren't necessarily going to have a speaker. But you could. You could have somebody come and say, tonight I'm going to tell you about my own shortcomings. And that, you know, that could be a very excellent stand-up comedian could do. I think that's the best kind of comedian, the ones who get up and tell you how stupid they are rather than how stupid other people are. People do sometimes pay good money when they're drunk to listen to somebody put down other people. But I think they could also might pay good money to listen to somebody when they're sober who's in a loving way telling about their own shortcomings. It's very entertaining. It should be entertaining, actually. Not exactly entertaining, but it should be joyful. We should learn a joyful way to talk about our own shortcomings. I say should, because if it's joyful, we will practice it. We will look forward to saying, I did this and I'm sorry. That, we should learn a way to do that that's joyful. So we'll do it more. Because the more we do it, the more beings are protected and the more people will get on board the fun practice of being aware of their shortcomings and sharing them with their friends and recommitting to skillful behavior. Again, the title of this talk was Living for the Welfare of the World, and the last line in the description was that the speaker would be talking about the importance of a life or the importance of living grounded in compassionate intent, or grounded in compassionate intention. I don't know who wrote that, but I thought, yeah, that sounds good. To look at how important it is to live a life that's grounded in compassionate intention. So that's sort of the ground. The ground is compassionate intention. So everything we do that's, you know, of consequence for spiritual evolution, it has to do with our intention. And everything we do spiritual evolution can go up or down. We can degenerate spiritually if we have one kind of intention. Like, I intend to put myself ahead of everyone. That's an intention. I wish to get at the head of the line. I wish to get more than everybody else. That's my intention. And that intention has a spiritual consequence, generally speaking, of causing misery to me and everybody else. Another intention would be, I have the intention to give my life to the welfare of others. Now, that could be the ground of our life. And I thought also when I heard that, it's like, you know, when you play the organ, you do this thing called sometimes a pedal point. A basic tone that you just keep reiterating. You do all this other stuff on the basis of it, but you do this pedal point. One time a friend of mine who's a violinist asked me to play the tamba. Is tamba a string instrument? Is it? I think it's an Indian string instrument. Simple one, not so complicated as a violin. Anyway, he taught me a certain melody to do while he did all his other stuff. And I just did that for the whole concert. So I tried to remember the basic message, the basic music, the basic tone running under or through everything is whatever I'm doing, if I'm moving my hand, horizontally through the air. I'm doing this for the welfare of others. When I speak, I try to remember that I'm speaking for the welfare of others. When I look at someone, I try to remember I'm looking at this person for the welfare of others. If I'm listening to someone, I'm listening for the welfare of others. I'm not doing it. Other reasons too, maybe, why I'm doing it. But the basic reason for everything I'm doing, I wish to make all my actions for the benefit of others. That's the basic, fundamental ground, and I think it's important. Matter of fact, I think it's basically that's the life of happiness. And if I live that way, maybe others will catch on to it and start living that way. Switch from making their own well-being the priority and others secondary to make others' welfare the priority and making their own secondary. Making my own secondary makes me happy. Making my own first makes me unhappy. So it's kind of a trick, I guess. That when you live for the welfare of others, you will be happy. But not just you. If they would learn that from you, they would also be happy. And once again, if I live for my own, if I put myself first, it's usually because the reason why I got to be first, among all the other people to put first, I just happened to wind up first. How did that happen? Well, it happened because I just happened to be attached to my own sense of self. So it's easy for me to find myself and put myself on top. It's hard to put one other person on top unless that person pretty much belongs to me. So then they're part of my own self things. So I put them first too. So human beings have this strange thing of thinking that there's a universe. I often use this example. You imagine the universe as a big circle, and they think there's a universe plus something. I make a drawing like this. Someone help me move this. Okay, you can stop there. I'm going to pivot it like this.
Okay.
So people often think like this. There's the universe plus something. Now, of course, rationally we know that there's not the universe plus something, right? But we think actually there's the universe plus there's something in addition to it. And guess what that is for each person? It's themselves. They think that they think there's a universe and them. But other people don't think there's a universe plus you. They think there's a universe plus them. It's funny that each person puts themselves up here in addition to the universe. Everybody puts a little peanut on top of the universe or on the side of the universe. And it just happens to be them. And then you can also make this person most important and so on and so forth. So, and this is the pattern, this is the basic affliction of human beings. And not just human beings, other living beings do this too. And little babies do it. People think, oh, babies are born perfectly enlightened. Well, they're born enlightened like adults are enlightened. They're enlightened, but they don't realize it, just like we don't, because they think like this too. We are nothing but the universe. What we really are is the whole universe. That's what we are. So, yeah. And we do want to help each other. We do. We have that in us, that we want to help others, especially others that we're doing something together with. So, how many people have heard the story of the acrobat? In the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha gave an example of the acrobats, and he said once there was an acrobat and he's apprenticed. And I think it's called a bamboo acrobat. So I imagine that that what the acrobat does is he puts a piece of bamboo pole on his chin or on top of his head. And then his apprentice, who in this story is his daughter, kind of smaller than him. So the acrobat and his daughter, who was going to climb up on his shoulders and climb up on top of the pole, which, again, the acrobat could be holding like this too, I suppose. But anyway, he's got this pole, and his daughter's getting up on his shoulders, and he says to his daughter, whose name, by the way, is Frying Pan, he says, "Now you take care of me, and I'll take care of you. We do want to take care of each other, and we want others to take care of us. That's fine." But he said to her, "You take care of me, and I'll take care of you." He wanted to take care of her, and he wanted her to take... That's fine. But she said, "You kind of... Venerable teacher, venerable father, you kind of have it a little bit off. It's... You take care of yourself, and I'll take care of myself, and then I can take care of you, and you can take care of me." So, again, in order to take care of others, we have to take care of ourselves. But we don't take care of ourselves for ourselves, we take care of ourselves for others. How do we take care of ourselves for others? By being aware of what we're thinking. Be aware of what our intentions are. So if you want to take care of others, it's good to look to yourself and think, am I actually, is there an intention here to help them now? Or not? What's going on with me? And the Buddha comments on the story. He says, the apprentice is right. You have to be aware of yourself. But you're not aware of yourself just for yourself. You're aware of yourself so that you can help others. If you're carrying somebody, you need to be aware of where your feet are and what the ground's like. If somebody asks you to do something, you need to be aware, and you want to do it, you need to be aware of whether you can do it or not. You have to check with yourself. Oh yeah, I'd like to do this, but actually I don't know how. So and so forth. So, and the Buddha says, how do you take care of yourself so that you can take care of others? By being aware of yourself. So, if we wish to live, to make everything for the welfare of others, if that's what we wish, we need to look and see, is that intention to make my action for the welfare of others, is that intention there? Yes, it is. Okay. And what other intention is there? Oh, there's some other ones too. Okay, that's more complicated. There is the intention to help, but there's a bunch of other stuff going on too, and it's good to know the other stuff. And you're the one who knows that they're there, so it's good for you to check. If there's not the intention to help others, then maybe you should try to find it before you try to help them. But even when there is the intention to help others, there's often some contradictory intention too. We're complex beings. We have deep, unconscious and conscious intentions that are not all lined up with helping other people. We are able to think of not helping somebody. We are able to think of putting ourselves first. So if I want to help people, I need to know. I want to help them, yes, I do. I want this to be for their welfare, but also I have another agenda, is I want it to be for mine. So then we watch that. We say, okay, I want to give this gift, but actually I would like them to say thank you. I would like to give this gift, but I hope somebody notices. And that they say, that was really cool what you did. That I want that too. Okay, well now... If I want to help people, if I want to help the environment, and I also want to become a little bit famous for it and get a Nobel Peace Prize, well, maybe I should wait a minute before I do this helpful thing. I'm kind of suggesting that we should wait. If we're actually going to try to do something to help, but really we're trying to get something for ourselves in the process, I think we should just be quiet with that until we can actually find the ability to give a gift and actually say, I think I can actually give this without expecting anything for it. I think it's there. I do want to help, and I'm actually not trying to get anything. So one of the ways to work up to that is like make anonymous donations where even the fundraisers don't know you're making it. Clean your neighborhood when nobody's watching. Bring presents to people where nobody can see. And even then, don't expect that when the people find them that they'll like them. You want them to appreciate. I want to give you a gift that will please you, but I got to be careful. I'm not trying to please you so that you'll like me. And it's possible that someone can go walk right up to you and give you a gift that pleases you, and you love the gift, and you do not like them any more than you did before. It can happen. Matter of fact, it's quite easy. That someone could give you a gift, and you may just like them so much you can't like them more anyway. So there's no way to increase. You just totally appreciate them, and there's no way to lift it up. You just continue to appreciate them. But some people you might not have much appreciation for, and they give you a gift which you do appreciate, and you don't appreciate them anymore. And some people can give you that and be happy that they gave it to you, not expecting you to appreciate them the slightest bit more. So if I give a gift and I notice that I wish for some reward, I actually don't give it. I mean, I shouldn't say I don't ever, because sometimes I chicken out. But my vow is actually not to give gifts expecting some reward. I may catch myself. Or even at the time I give it, I may not notice it, but later I find out. I gave it, I thought, I didn't expect anything. And then when nobody says thank you, I say, well, it kind of hurts. I really did. Now I see I did expect something for it. So it's very important for me to study myself if I wish to live for the welfare of others. So the Buddha says, how do you take care of yourself so that you can help others? By being aware of your own intentions, basically. And then how do you help others? Well, you help them by being generous, patient, nonviolent. That's how you help others. But in order to be that way with people, you have to be aware of yourself. Of course, when you do treat people that way, of course, that's the way you take care of others, which take care of you. So you have to take care of yourself to take care of others, and you have to take care of others to take care of yourself. But it's somewhat different. The way you take care of yourself is by awareness of your intention, your intention, your intention. And the more you're aware of the intention, the more I'm aware of my intention, the more I see my shortcomings, and the more I see my shortcomings, the more my intentions develop positively, and the more I'm protected from any unwholesome intentions. I'm more and more protected from unwholesome intentions by becoming aware of them. Joyfully and kindly aware of them. And then I will relate to other people in such a way that without expecting any reward, I will get rewards. It's very nice to be nonviolent with people. It's actually wonderful. But again, to be nonviolent, to get something is a little bit violent. People really do like us, deep down, to give us gifts with no expectation. They're kind of wondering, actually. This person's giving me a big gift. I wonder if they could. I'm actually giving it with no expectation. They don't look like they're saying, now you give me something. But I'm going to check to make sure they're not trying to get anything by not saying thank you. And I didn't say thank you, and they didn't wince. So they're not saying, do you have something you want to say to me? When I was a little boy, well, I wasn't so little. I'm not very big now, but when I was 13, I was kind of big for my age. And I was actually having a hard time when I was 13. For some reason or other, I was suffering. And it was a Sunday afternoon like this, and I was in my own room at my house. And the thought occurred to me, if I would just go to school tomorrow and just concentrate on being kind to everybody, all my problems would disappear. And I felt great to discover that. And I remember going up the hill to my school. I lived at the bottom of a hill, and the school was up on top. I went up the hill and opened the door with the intention of being that way that day in school. But when I saw, particularly the beautiful young girls, when I saw them, I forgot. Now you might think, well, wouldn't it be easy to remember to just be kind to those nice, those beautiful young girls? But I forgot. I got concerned with, what do those beautiful young girls think of me? What do those boys think of me? What do my friends think of me? I forgot about it. I couldn't remember. It was a great insight, but I couldn't figure out how to practice it. Because in the onslaught of the juiciness of social life, it's easy to forget the ground of living for the welfare of others. When we see the richness of our social relationships, we often start thinking, what's going to happen to me? How am I going to do in this situation? Where am I going to fit in this picture? So I had trouble practicing this great insight. And then a couple years later, I read some Zen stories, and I read stories about people who, when something happened to them, they came back with compassion. And I thought, there it is. That's what I want. That's the way I want to be. But it also occurred to me, how do you get to be that way? I mean, it's a good idea, but how do you get to be that way? And then I found out that these people who could act in that way, of like, when something happens to them, their response was already, you know, how can I help this other person, rather than, what does this do for me or against me? I found out that they all did the same training program. That basically the same training program of sitting quietly, studying their own intentions, and noticing how their intentions worked, the quality of the intention, and the suffering or happiness that comes from the type of intention you have. But again, if you hear, like I did, and now you hear me saying, if your intention is to help others, all happiness comes from that. If your intention is to help yourself, all unhappiness comes from that. Because our intention to help ourselves is connected to self-clinging, and our intention to help others can gradually be free of self-clinging. That's where happiness comes from. That's where unhappiness comes from. You hear that, fine. Now, how do you remember it? Well, you have to have special training sessions where you sit down and look at that. Look at that intention and look at those teachings and remember them over and over and over until it starts to change your mind. So your mind remembers this even when you meet people and they go, hello, how are you feeling? How am I feeling now? Whoa. How can I remember when somebody says, how are you feeling? How can I remember what I really want to do in this conversation? And then answer the question. It's hard. You have to train at it. We easily get dislodged from that way of being back into me first. That's the, what do you call it, fallback position. Me first. It's deeply wired. So then I thought, well, maybe I'll go someplace and get trained at that. So I went someplace and got trained at it, and I'm still getting trained at it, and there's still more training to be trained. But I'm very happy to have gone to a place where people support me to talk about this all the time, because when I talk about it, I often think, this sounds good. Like I give meditation instruction and say, I'd like to try that. So I'm in a position where by talking about it a lot, I actually practice it a little. And it's really wonderful to practice it. Talking about looking at intentions, I actually do occasionally, and I never regret it. It's wonderful to study myself, even though what I find sometimes is not so pretty. Sometimes I find selfishness. Sometimes I find competitiveness. Sometimes I find envy. Sometimes I find maybe even some ill will I might find. But I'm very happy that I found it, because I feel like, oh, this is what the enlightened people have done. Enlightened people have studied themselves for a long time, and they found junk when they studied themselves for a long time. Even the Buddhas, the historical Buddha, reports that he looked at himself and he found embarrassing material, which he confessed and which his disciples remembered and wrote down. Like he said, one time I saw old people and I felt kind of some disgust. But I felt ashamed to feel disgust. It's ridiculous to feel disgust when you see old people, because unless you die now, quite soon, you're going to be one too. And then you're going to be disgusted with yourself? Well, probably not. You probably still think, I'm still cute. But those people, they're kind of repulsive. The Buddha thought like that before becoming fully enlightened. So, again, before Buddhas were Buddhas, they were like us. Except they were like us if we are studying ourselves. If we're not studying ourselves, then we're not like Buddhas. Except, well, maybe even at one time, way, way back, Buddhas, before there were Buddhas, weren't even studying themselves. But all the problems we have, enlightened people basically have had, but they studied them, and they studied them, and they were kind to them. And because they were kind to these shortcomings, they stopped dwelling in them. And when they stopped dwelling with them, they opened to the wonderful truth of life, and then it passed through them to other beings. So this is the great possibility, is we can actually realize the truth if we study ourselves, and we can study ourselves if we really want to live for the welfare of others, because in order to live for the welfare of others, we have to study ourselves. Inattention to our own intentions will trip us up in the intention of helping others. And we don't every moment necessarily have the intention to help others, but we always have some intention. And we can learn to pay attention to our intention. And if we do, that will facilitate the intention to help others completely. And it's hard work. So we really need to be convinced that it's important. It's important to live for the welfare of others, and it's also important to notice if we don't want to live for the welfare of others. Part of us doesn't want to. Part of us wants to live for our own welfare first. And if you really can notice that, it can be basically eradicated or lose its power. And then the wish to help others will be unhindered. And that will be, well, that's the greatest happiness for ourselves and others. Well, that maybe is a start. And if anybody would like to come up and discuss anything with me, or with Taigen, or with yourself, please come up.
I'm a special chair for you.
Hi, if
anybody would like to, oh, please come, David.
Yeah. Sit down here, really?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. This is a rare opportunity for me,
yeah.
Selfishly, because you run, correct?
Yeah.
You have run, and I think you still do run.
Yeah.
So, and you're a Zen teacher, so I can ask you this question.
All right.
So for my...
Do you run also?
I do. I do, fairly often. So actually, I started a whole business where it's a dog running company. So we run the dogs That's what we do. We run the dogs for exercise. And I probably started it pretty selfishly because I like to run and I like the dogs. But it's interesting because people ask, after doing it for a few years, people say, do you get tired of doing that all the time? But actually, I don't, because, you know, the benefit feedback loop is pretty quick, because you just get to see how happy these dogs are to be running.
Wow, wonderful.
They're just really, really happy to be doing it, so it doesn't get old. It's sort of refreshing, which you know, that seems like a good sign. But then you run so much, and then, you know, they have races.
Dog people races?
No, just races for people.
Oh, people races.
People races.
Without the dogs.
Right.
Okay.
So they have the marathon races, and, you know, I did a few of those. And then they have the longer races, the ultra distance races. So, and I may have thought to myself, well, for, you know, I wanted to see if I could do it. That's sort of the challenge of seeing if I could put myself through that and succeed and do it, which was probably kind of selfish. But then I found that there was some, you know, lessons learned in doing that that maybe allowed me to be more helpful, like discipline and forbearance and stuff. So I did a couple, like, 50-mile races and kind of like that. And then, you know, you get into this thing, and then now they have 100-mile races. So then I was like, ooh, I do a 100-mile race. But then that felt pretty self-indulgent. That felt kind of selfish, so I said, okay, I'll do the 100-miler, but I'll do it as a fundraiser. So I'll raise money for the dog shelter. It's like, you know, I feel like I'm not just doing it for me, but we'll try to help some more dogs. So I did that and finished the race and, you know, raised the money and everything. So that was good. But now, you know, I have friends that are doing this now, so now I think, well, maybe I'll do another 100-miler. But this time maybe not do it for charity. So it's like, I could say to myself, you know, so, but I'm like, you know, that's, maybe that's, you're a runner, so I'm curious at what you think, but I'm thinking that maybe that's kind of selfish. You know, that's like, you know, it takes 25 to 30 hours, and travel and resources and time and energy. So I could maybe say to myself, well, I'm doing this because I get fitter and stronger, and then I stay healthier and I can run more dogs and benefit more dogs. Or maybe I'm just rationalizing it that way. So I struggle with that, like, a little bit.
Yeah. So you said, maybe I'm just rationalizing it, and maybe I'm just some selfish motivation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's good to be open to that there might be some selfish motivation. And if we're open to selfish motivation, that often makes it easy for us to actually discover the selfish motivation. Sometimes we can discover the selfish motivation without actually... Sometimes we get surprised and we get to discover that we're selfish without even opening to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the openness to it, that part of helping others is to be open to selfish motivation. If you want to help others, one of the things to do along with that is to be open to that you might be selfish. So you sound like you're open to that you might be selfish, and whatever path you take, I hope you continue to always be open to that you might be selfish. And then you can get revelations that you're selfish, and then if you take care of the selfishness, it's possible that you won't get caught by it. And then you still might want to do a 100-mile race. I don't know. It's possible.
Okay.
But it's also possible that you say, oh, now I see that actually, yeah, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm not interested in a 100-mile race. I am, however, interested in a 99-mile race. And that, I think, that would be really cool. And the reason why I want to do that, I don't see any selfish motivation there, but I'm gonna watch to see if I see any. Like, again, to act and to act and be seeking benefit from myself, all suffering comes from that. to act seeking welfare for others, happiness of others, all happiness comes from that. And it's more complicated than that. It's time to go running now. Are you going running for the welfare of others? Do you have time to go running? I think so. Do you have time to ask that question? If I ask the question about whether I'm going running for the welfare of others, that's going to cut into my running time a little bit. And I don't have time for that, to ask that question. I said, well, since we're talking, I'm kind of surprised that you don't have time to go running for many hours, but you don't have time to ask whether this running is really for the welfare of others. I mean, that's whether you're intending it for that reason. And you might say, okay, I'll look. And what'd you find? Well, actually, I don't know if it's for the welfare. I would like it to be for the welfare of others. I actually would, but I don't know if it is. But I did check, and I do feel like I would like my running right now. I'm going to go running, and I hope it's for the welfare of others. I'm dedicating it to the welfare of others. I'm saying this is what I want it to be for. I don't know if it is, but this is what I want it to be for. And also, I'm open to that. At any point along the way, I may discover it's really that I'm doing it for selfish reasons, and I'll deal with that when I find out about it. And then I might say to you, would you please call off the run today and do something else with me? And you might say, okay. Or you might say, no, actually, I thought I was unselfish, but now I realize I do. I don't want. I want to help people this way, not the way you're asking me to. That's why it's good to have always have a Zen master right nearby.
They have races in California. I'll be right there.
He's saying, could we call off the race now? Could you give it up, please? Please give it up. Mm-hmm. And the Zen master maybe feels bad about that, if it would hurt you a little bit to find out that it hurts to give up this thing you were planning on doing. Because after all, it was for the welfare of others. But it also giving it up would be for the welfare of others. And once you give it up for the welfare of others, you say, great. Now would you please go run 100 miles for the welfare of others? You say, okay. So we have to keep training ourselves around this. Somebody in a class the other night said, now if I want to put salt on my food, you know, should I wonder about putting salt in my food? You know, like, do you put salt in the food? Most people put salt in their food because they seek to make their food more enjoyable for themselves. They don't necessarily think, well, I'm trying to stimulate the salt economy. Most people don't think that. They think, I want to make this is a little bit more interesting to eat. Now, are you doing that for the welfare of others or for yourself? So this person said, well, should I wonder when I put salt on things, you know, if I'm doing this for the welfare of others? And I said, I think it would be great if you did. I think it would be great if I did. And since that conversation with him, this isn't the first time I thought of this, but since that conversation with him, I've been watching, in the meals I've had since then, I've been watching the impulse to put salt on things. Now, is me putting salt on things for the welfare of others? I think a lot of people do want me to eat. You know, if I ask them, would it be beneficial to you if I ate? And they say, well, actually, not necessarily now, but we do want you to eat sometimes because we want you to live a little longer. We do want you to eat, but actually, you've eaten enough now. You can stop now. But does anybody really want me to put salt in my food? I don't know if anybody does. Well, how about the salt company people? maybe even they don't want me to. So what am I putting the salt on? I think it's good to wonder, what am I up to when I put salt on food? Now, some people, as you know, have practiced giving up the impulse to put salt on food as an experiment to see what food tastes like before you put the salt on. Sometimes people say, the food's already salted. Taste it first before you put the salt on. Some people put salt on it before they even taste it. That isn't necessarily benefiting them. But what are they doing? They're often like, before they even think of what's beneficial, they're trying to benefit themselves. If they stop for a second and say, well, what is actually beneficial to all beings? And say, probably would be good if I tasted this food without salt, without salting it first. That probably would be good for everybody. And then I could find out if I would like more salt. And if I like more salt, then would it be good to wonder if it's good to put more salt on, if I would like more salt? And I would say, I think it would be very good to wonder, would this be beneficial to all beings for me to put more salt on just to get that kick? Is to get that little would that, does that help other people, and does it help me to be doing that kind of thing? I only have a certain amount of time left. With the time I could spend putting the salt on, I could be remembering what I'm here for. Instead of going like this, I could stop saying, now what's the point again of life? Oh yeah, right. Now is it going to help all beings for me? Do I think that? And I don't know if it's going to help all beings, but am I putting the salt on to help all beings? And am I going running today to help all beings? And I think, in your case, I think most people probably would say, David, we do want you to keep running. We appreciate that you are taking care of your body, and we appreciate that you're doing this nice thing for the dogs. We actually want you to go running. But we're not sure we want you to run 100 miles. But we're not telling you not to either. But we do want you to be looking at yourself and asking, am I really going the 100 miles to help? Is it really for the sake of others that I'm going the 100 miles? Do my doggies really want me to go for 100 miles? And I don't know what the answer to the question is. But even if the doggies say, yeah, go ahead, go for it, we want you to. That doesn't mean you should. But the point is that you keep asking, is this, am I doing this for others? Asking that question, we need, for the sake of the welfare of the world, we need to keep asking ourselves, what am I up to? What's this about? And then sometimes you find, oh, this really is selfish. That's what it's about. It's not for others. Nobody wants me to do it. Nobody cares if I do this. If I do it, they'll love me. Compassionate people will still be compassionate to me, but they don't really want me to do this. They want me to run with my dogs. They want me to run with my friends. They want me to encourage other people to take care of themselves. That's what they want. They don't want me to do this superhuman thing. But if I do, they'll work on themselves and try to help me. But they do want me to be looking at myself. They would really appreciate that. So that's your job. And then what you need to find out.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
That's a great example. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else care to bring anything up this evening? This afternoon? Please come.
I've heard you say, and I've heard other people say things about looking at themselves and then taking care, being kind with their shortcomings. And I never quite understand what that means. You said yesterday, that in the absence of self-clinging, that human beings can bear almost any kind of pain. And with self-clinging, even the smallest pains become sort of unbearable.
Right.
But self-clinging itself is the great pain, isn't it? How do you take care of that?
Self-clinging isn't painful. It comes to fruit as pain. It's just a grasping. The grasping isn't painful, but it produces pain. It's an action. Self-clinging is an action based on delusion that there's something to grasp out there.
that there's something independent. That delusion, then we approve of it and act on it. That has consequence of misery for ourselves and others.
So what does it mean to take care of the self clinging,
and you do the same thing with the self clinging that you do with the pain. It's easier for people to find pain than self clinging. Almost everybody, many people, almost everybody can notice pain. And if they can't, we'll help them. But most people can find pain. Self-clinging is a little bit more subtle. Even though it's kind of gross, it's more subtle than the pain itself. It's like the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, right? The first is the truth of suffering. Well, what's that? Well, it's subtle, but anyway, there's suffering that you can be aware of. That's part of the truth. The second truth is that suffering has an origin. The origin is this self-clinging. It's this grasping and the thirst around it. So if you study your suffering, you can find something, some self-clinging in the neighborhood, probably. But the way you treat the suffering is the same way, basically the same way to treat the self-clinging. And that is to be kind to it.
And what does that mean? What does that mean, kind to
it? It means to welcome it. It means say welcome. Welcome pain. Not I like you or don't like you. Welcome. Welcome pain. Welcome pain. Welcome suffering. Welcome. Be generous with it. Say gracias. Gracious. Thank you. Not I like you or dislike you. I don't like pain. I mean, I might have a tendency to dislike it, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about welcoming. We're talking about being a great host. Of letting what comes into your life, it's here, let it, welcome it in. Let it be generous, let it be what it is. Don't give up trying to control it. Give up trying to control your grasping, selfish tendencies. Self-clinging is the great demon of our life. Give up trying to beat this great demon. You're not going to beat it. But if you say welcome to the great demon, if you give up trying to control it, the demon will become pacified. Like there's a Zen koan, a Zen story. Teacher says, who can untie the bell string around the tiger's neck? Who can do that? The one who tied the bell string around the tiger's neck can do it. Tiger didn't tie them. Tigers can't tie bell strings around their neck. Somebody did that. Who did that? The one who did it can untie it. If you are kind to the demon, you can pacify the demon. If you push the demon away, the demon just flares up. Self-clinging, denied, becomes more powerful. It's fed by denial. If you ignore it, it's fed by ignorance. If you're cruel to it, it just gets more powerful. If you try to control it, it gets more powerful. If you notice it, that's good. Then when you notice it, to try to get rid of it, it makes it more powerful. Welcoming it weakens it, softens it, makes it more and more pliable and relaxed. Be calm with it. Be patient with it and the pain it causes. Be patient with it and the pain it causes. Don't be overbearing. Don't look down on it. And then you can be with this self-clinging without dwelling in the self-clinging. And the self-clinging is just an illusion. It's imagining something that can't actually happen. Then you don't dwell in it. And then the Dharma flows through life. But of course, it's sometimes difficult to welcome pain, isn't it? But not impossible. You know, one of the advantages of being a human female is that if you get pregnant, you have a chance to experience welcoming pain.
especially at that precious moment of being a mother who's delivering a baby. A lot of pain, but this, but there's a lot of support for you to actually open up and relax with it. It's still painful. It doesn't take the pain away. It's still pain, still big pain, but you have this opportunity to relax with it or fight it. And if you can relax with a big pain, that's a great moment. Because relaxing with a big pain, if it's 85% relaxing, it's still the 15% of fighting a big pain is still really makes it a lot worse. Where if it's big and you open, if you relax to it completely, you can actually be quite conscious and blissful. You can learn that you can be in bliss with extreme pain. And also, most people experience, although they don't understand, that they're in extreme pain over minor pain. They're extremely suffering over minor pains. Like I sometimes say, if I ever commit suicide, it would probably be because getting a rude operator. You know, now people don't talk to the operator so much, but it used to be you'd call the operator and sometimes they weren't very helpful. It's a little irritating, right?
All right, speaking of pain.
Yeah.
I'm in chronic pain physically.
Yes.
And I don't really complain about it. I just go along with the flow because it's not going to do me any good to say anything.
It's not going to do any good, right?
I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm just doing my thing. And is that good, bad, or indifferent?
It sounds pretty good. But the pain's looking for sympathy.
It's there.
It's there, and it's calling for somebody to love it. So you're not complaining. That sounds great. But I would encourage you, in addition to not complaining, to positively welcome it. Welcoming the pain is an act of love. You can grow, and I can grow, and we can grow great compassion by loving the pain. Not liking it, but loving it.
Sometimes it's just like you just put it out of your whole mind, your whole system. It's there, and it's it.
So I would encourage myself not to put it out of my mind, but to welcome it into my mind, to use the pain as an opportunity to develop compassion. For you to. If you're not complaining, you're already setting a good example for other people who are in pain. So your lack of complaining is good. But I would say take another step. Don't just say no complaining, also say thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. And I'm not in so much pain right now myself. At this moment, I'm not in much physical pain. But I'm training for the pain that's coming. Pain will, if I keep living, pain is going to come. Big pain is going to come. I've had some big pains, and some of them, when they came, I said welcome. And when I said welcome, I said how wonderful that I've been practicing and getting ready for this pain. When it came, I actually said welcome. I'm so happy I could say welcome. I try to practice welcome with lots of little pains. So I remember, so it's built into my body to say welcome when pain comes. So that when the big ones come, I might be able to say welcome too. Because it's not even remembering, it's trained into me. If we keep living, we're all going to have big physical challenges. So I'm trying to train myself all these years to get ready to be loving to the big challenges that are coming. And I might even get I also know that this thing called Alzheimer's can happen.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Now, this lady here doesn't have Alzheimer's. She's very sharp still.
I hope so.
Well, you are. You've got almost all my jokes. I saw you. You're still very sharp. But I might not be so sharp in a few years. So I'm training my body to keep practicing, even if my mind can't remember, you know, what happened 10 seconds ago, or what my name is, or who you are. That can happen to us. But we can train ourselves so that on a spiritual level, we continue to practice compassion. But we have to train ourselves. It's not going to, even children who don't train themselves, who have these excellent facilities, they don't train themselves, they don't respond compassionately to pain. Because they're not trained. But if we don't start training ourselves, we're going to respond like children. We're going to be concerned for our own welfare indefinitely. And that's the bummer. If you can say welcome to your pain, that will be very important. That will be very encouraging to many other people. And not only that, but I'm saying for me to learn to say welcome to my pain, not just so that I'm more comfortable with my pain, which I will be, but I do this for the sake of others, because I know people need to learn this, and I would like to tell them, you can learn this. I practiced it and I learned it. You can learn it too. You have the capacity to be to grow compassion on your physical pain. The pain may stay the same, but this beautiful compassionate flower will grow out of it. If you not just say don't complain, which is important, at least you're neutral when you say it, when you don't complain. But to be positive, not which I like it, but positive in the sense of I love it. I love the pain, which means not that I like it, but I welcome it. And I welcome it because it's life. And I affirm life no matter what form it comes. And this is challenging, but I have learned to say welcome. Just again, like a woman having a baby, she welcomes the situation. She doesn't, it's painful, but she welcomes it. And this is the greatest moment of life. And for people who are not having babies, we have other pains to do the same thing with. And I say this to you because I've had pain and I'm going to have pain. And I practice with pain and I really believe in this. But I don't practice it just for me. I practice it for everybody. And that makes me even more enthusiastic, because it will help many people if you can learn to welcome your physical challenges. It will help everybody, even people who don't see you, it will help. I believe that. Please.
I have a question about thinking and emotional pain. I had an experience, someone yelled at me and I was upset, and I tried to focus on the feelings that were happening at the time and not add additional thinking to sort of keep that feeling going. And so after about a minute and a half, I started feeling better and just not pushing away the feeling. I started feeling better. And then later, I thought about the incident again, and I started to get upset again. So I wasn't sure if I was using mindfulness as a way to escape the original pain. Because it goes away if I think about it, you know, if I only focus on what's happening now and don't think about the thoughts. But then when I think about the thought later, was I not processing that properly? Was I running away from it by doing that? Probably the intention was to not have the pain anymore.
In the original situation?
after I was upset.
No, when it was when you actually were feeling upset.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think probably your intention was to not have the pain anymore?
Yeah. Probably that was the main motivation to, to go into mindfulness rather than the thinking, because that seems like that'll work better than just thinking about it.
This is a complicated example, but but we can look at it now. Okay, so somebody says something to you and it hurts, and it could hurt for different reasons. Someone could actually hit you, and the physical sensation of pain might not be due to your story about what's going on. But if someone yells at you, probably in most cases, the pain you would feel would be from two sources. One source would be the pain you might feel compassionately would be you feel pain that they're doing something which hurts them. But that would be a compassionate pain, which would feel one kind of, that would feel one way.
Mm-hmm.
The pain you feel when someone is being unskillful towards you is actually, I mean, the pain you feel when someone's being unskillful for you, when you love them, is compassion. And that's a joy. It's a joy to feel pain when someone you love is doing something that hurts them. So when you feel compassion towards someone, you care about them, and their pain hurts you. But it's a joy that you feel pain about them in that case. The other case, another case would be they're yelling at you, and they're being unskillful or skillful, I don't know yet. But you have a story, and your story is painful to you. In the case of compassion, you're already mindful. And the pain you feel is a joy. It's already mindfulness. You're not trying to escape the pain. You're perfectly... Compassion is basically joy. In the second case, if your story is hurting you, then mindfulness won't necessarily be to escape the story. It will be able to... You're aware, I have this story that they're hurting me, and that story is what hurts. Now, you could, in addition, be paying attention to your story for a selfish reason or an unselfish reason. You could be practicing mindfulness of your stories and how painful they are for the welfare of others, or you could be doing it for your own welfare. If it's possible to do wholesome things for your own welfare, and they're still wholesome, but the trying to get something for yourself taints them. Once again, you can do wholesome things. You can do skillful things. And they really are skillful, but you can be doing them for your own welfare, and they really are good, but they're doing it for your own welfare. That part will taint it, and that part will cause pain to you later, even though what you're doing is good. And one more example is, you can also be doing something unskillful and be observing that. Well, actually, being mindful of it is skillful. But again, you can be mindful for the welfare of others, or you can be mindful for your own sake. So being mindful is, generally speaking, beneficial. And if you're doing it for yourself, there will be a kickback. And if you're doing it for others, there will be a kickback, but the kickback will be joy, and in the other case, it will be. So, but in your story, I feel like I don't know whether you did it for the welfare of others in the first place or for your own welfare, but I felt like when it came up again, you didn't do the mindfulness practice the second time.
Yeah.
That's what I felt. The first time you did it, and it was skillful, aside from what your basic motivation was, the second time you didn't practice mindfulness. And because you didn't practice mindfulness with this painful story, the painful story flared up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing about mindfulness, is when you practice it, you're in a good position to further check what your motivation in practicing mindfulness is. Mindfulness is basically does calm down the pain in the first case. In the second case, you didn't practice it, so when the story came back, it flared up the way it probably would have the first time if you hadn't done it.
Mm-hmm.
So once you're doing something wholesome, like paying attention to what's going on, what your story is, that does calm your story down and give you some relief. Then you can go deeper and not say, now what is my motivation in doing this skillful thing? So the good thing about skillful things is that you can notice even more deeply how skillful they are. Whereas if you're being unskillful, you can't even get at your motivation, you're so upset. You're so confused and in so much torment about this bad story, and you're not mindful of it, so you don't really not, you say, well, probably I'm not the least bit concerned for the welfare of others. I'm totally, who knows what I'm doing. But if you actually are in trouble and you pay attention to the trouble, you say, oh, there's trouble, but I'm aware and I'm present. And I'm calm. But it's still trouble. It's a too difficult story. People are being mean to me. Are people being unskillful? This is difficult, but I'm actually present with it. Now I can check, am I doing this for the welfare of others? And I'm not answering the question yet, but I'm going deeper in my mindfulness. And I feel encouraged to continue. Mm-hmm. There's a joy in this. And I haven't even answered the question yet about whether it's for the welfare of others. But now that even though I haven't answered it, I do now wish to continue this for the welfare of others. I wish to continue this practice of mindfulness so that I can kind of be in my place. And when you're in your place, when you're suffering and you're in your place, that's also called patience. If you're in pain and you come to the present of it, you can tolerate much more pain than if you're in pain and you think about how long it's going on and how long it will be going on. Then it flares up. So being in the present, being mindful, doesn't make the pain smaller. It just, you're taking a smaller bite of the pain. Bite-sized bits of pain you can handle, and if you can't, you'll just pass out. No problem. Like Tayo told me about when he goes to the dentist, he doesn't get pain medication. But he goes, he practices trying to be in the present with the pain, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And he's able to do the treatments without pain medication so far. So that's mindfulness and mindfulness and patience are closely connected. You have to be mindful to be patient. Now, you don't have to be patient in order to be mindful, because when you're in pleasure, it's not really pain. It's not patience. But you do have to be mindful to be patient. And when something painful happens, when you have a painful story about what's going on, to be in the present with it does not reduce the pain. It just, you're taking the pain in more reasonable doses, which the best dose to take pain is the moment, the present moment, the present moment. So then you do calm down, and it is more palatable. You can stand it. You can bear it. You can endure it. And then now that you're present, now you can say, am I doing this practice of patience for the welfare of others or for myself? Now your mindfulness is deepening. If answer comes, fine. And then, now that I'm doing this, I would like to now consider and say, I would like to continue this practice for the welfare of others. And I'll keep wondering if I am doing it for the welfare of others, but I wish to do it for the welfare of others. Now I'm in pain, I'm present, I'm mindful, I'm patient, I'm generous, or I'm practicing generosity. This is good. And I wish to do this for the welfare of others. This is the way I want to live.
It seems like there's a lot of motivation that can naturally come up when we're doing something for the welfare of ourselves. And wondering if that gets mixed up too much when I'm trying to think of the welfare of others is also the welfare of myself. And so when I'm taking care of myself, I'm taking care of myself so that I can take care of others. Maybe that can happen as I say, well, I would like to continue taking care of myself in this way.
Yeah.
And hopefully it doesn't get too mixed up with the self-clinging before then.
I don't know if I'd hope for that.
Okay.
I would just say, if it gets mixed up, I wish to face it and welcome it and not dwell in it. So I'm not trying to eliminate messy situations. I'm not asking for them, but I'm also not trying to make life simpler so that I'll be able to practice better. I hope that I can be present, but I don't necessarily hope that life will be simple. I think I understand that I need challenge. I'm not asking for it, but I understand I need it. So when it comes, and I think it's going to, I want to be ready to welcome the challenges, not say I don't want any more challenges, because then I won't grow. But please, I'm not asking for any more challenges. But if you send them, I'm here to say, I'm committed to welcome you.
Thank you.
to talk a little more about what you've mentioned a couple of times about checking intention before doing something for the benefit of others. And if you feel that there's some self-clinging in there, to refrain from doing that. And I guess my concern about that is...
I wouldn't quite make that general.
Okay.
I would say, particularly in the case of making gifts,
mm-hmm.
if you feel like you're trying to get something from the gift, realize that it's not going to be giving. You may still go ahead and do it, but you're basically, you know, purchasing something. So, but don't confuse yourself and think that you're giving a gift when you're actually trying to get something.
I think another point you made, though, is key, because I self-clinging, the desire for approval, other people's approval, or your own approval, is pervasive and pernicious. And I think that in giving gifts or doing things for other people, we can recognize that it's important to do that for them, and at the same time recognize, gee, I hope they'll appreciate it, or I hope they'll say thank you. But it's still important for them to have it. And I wonder about whether it isn't important to say, I understand that I really hope they'll say thank you, or gee, what a great person I am to have given this gift, but they really need this gift.
Okay, so let's take an example of, like, it's time to serve your children dinner,
mm-hmm.
and you feel they really need dinner, okay? And so you're going to put dinner out there for them, okay?
I want them to say, boy, Dad, what a great dinner! You're a wonderful cook.
I'm happy that you're committed. I'm happy that you're confessing to us that you want them to say, "Thanks, Dad." Okay, but I just want to say to you this now example.
Okay,
these children are there, and you're feeling like they need this food,
mm-hmm.
and your primary concern is to get them the food. You feel like they need it. That's the agenda here, is to get them the food. You really feel that, and they do need it. And now, can you just give it to them because they need it without getting into this other thing? Now, if you say, no, I can't, because as soon as coming right along with getting them the food is I want something for myself by giving them the food. Okay, now, and Reb says, don't give it to them if you're trying to get something for yourself. But they need it. So then if I was right next to you, you'd say, okay, Reb, they need this food, and I want them to be grateful to me and say thank you. And you're telling me not to give it to them, right? And I say, no, give it to them, but realize that you're not giving. You're not practicing giving here. You are offering them something, and you're taking away the giving side of it because of this quality. You're distracting yourself from the practice of giving by trying to get something. But they do need it, so please give it to them.
I wonder, though, don't we have mixed motives for doing a lot
we,
of things?
We
if
do.
Our kids,
we do.
Your kid, you serve and a dinner, you, and he says, you have this
mixed,
is terrible.
Yeah, and when you have
You'll
mixed motives, when you have mixed motives about giving, you're not giving. You're distracting yourself from the giving. Because sometimes you know you can give them the food without wishing that they'll thank you. There's some people you can give food to, and you do not need them to say thank you. It's enough for you that they eat the food. Like some people, like if you have a sick child, okay? Now your child's sick, and she's not eating. And she won't eat, or everything she eats, she throws up. So you put food into her mouth, and it goes down, and she doesn't throw it up. You are not concerned at that time that she says, thanks, Dad. All you care about at that moment is, oh my God, she's eating. At that point, you're just giving. And you're totally joyful to give this to her. And you're not the least bit concerned with getting the reward. That's why you can keep feeding her, even the reward that she'll eat. You've tried to feed her many times, you know, and you learned that that when expecting her to eat just made you more miserable and made you less able to keep feeding her. So you stopped expecting that she would eat. And because you stopped expecting she would eat, you kept feeding her. And finally she ate, and you're so happy she received the gift. And you weren't trying to get anything. So there it is. That's giving. And that's a joy to you. And it's completely undefiled. But then if you try to give it to her again, expecting that she's going to eat more, then you slipped again. Or then you say, well, now she's eating, so now maybe she can start saying thank you to me. Or when she gets well, you know, maybe she'll say thank you. Then you're getting off the track again. But again, as, what's your name again?
Eric.
Eric. As Eric asked, when you get off the track, what do? In other words, when you start giving presents to your, gifts to your children, and you start being concerned for them saying thank you, what do? I'd say, well, be generous to the, practice giving with your defiling impulse around the giving.
Mm-hmm.
Practice giving with that.
I guess that's the question. Isn't there value in recognizing that there's some desire for appreciation at the same time that
yes.
you're giving the gift?
Yes.
If they say, this is terrible.
This is an example.
You'll be back the next night.
If you being aware of what's going on with you, in order for you to help the world, you need to be aware that you're trying to get something. That it helps. It helps me. It helps everybody if you're aware that you're trying to get something. That's part of how you will be helpful to the whole world, is to be aware of any selfish motivation in yourself. That doesn't. The selfish motivation, I don't know what to say about that, but you being aware of it, that's good. The selfish motivation, I don't know what to say about it, but in order for you to be helpful, whether you have selfish motivation or not, being aware will help you be helpful. So that is definitely part of the deal of living for the welfare of the world, is for me to be aware that I have some expectation of reward or desire for appreciation. But you can have desire for appreciation and say, I wish people would appreciate me, but I'm giving this gift, and I do not care whether they appreciate me or not, even though I'd like them to. I'd like people to be kind to me, and at the same time, I don't care if they're kind to me. I like this, and I don't care if I get it. Because my joy comes from giving to people, not from getting stuff that I want. I do want stuff. I do. But to act to get things makes me miserable. But I don't have to stop being a person who wants things. You can want things. But to spend your life trying to get them, that's misery. That's where misery comes from. But you don't have to not be a person who wants. You don't have to not be a person who wants things. You can be a person who wants things. The Buddhas want things. They want people to be happy. They want that. But they're not attached to it. They're not attached to people being happy. Therefore, they just keep wanting it. If you're attached to things, you get all pushed out of shape and you stop wanting them sometimes. Because it causes so much misery to be attached to what you want. So you stop wanting, because like somebody told me, you know, I think my problem with you is I have expectations of you. I want something from you. So what I decided to do is just stop wanting things from you. And it helped me to not want anything to do. And also, in order to not want things from you, I'm going to stop caring about you and stop loving you. Then I'll want less from you. That's the way to go, right? Just stop loving people, and that'll tone down the pain of your expectations. I say turn love up so that you can realize how destructive expectations are. And then you'll give them up. But you have to be present with them and loving them. And so it's great that you're aware of that. And yeah. Is that clear now?
Yeah, I'm interested in the idea that maybe there is some merit in being aware and continuing anyway, in spite of a selfish motive, saying, well, if it doesn't turn out tough for you, but the kid still needs to be fed.
Right, but then again, you still feed the kid, but you don't delude yourself and think that you're practicing giving. you're just doing a reasonable, you are doing a reasonable thing of feeding a child. That's mm-hmm. good. But you don't think you're doing just bodhisattva practice of selfless giving. You don't think that because you're not, right?
I guess not.
Yeah. You're not. I mean, you notice that you're not. I'm trying to get something. Well, that's not the bodhisattva practice. Bodhisattvas are giving the food to the child just for the child. They're not trying to get the child to, you know, send in a nomination for you to be the greatest dad of all time. That's not what the bodhisattvas are doing. They're not trying to have people think they're great. They're trying to help people. So if you're trying to help your child, that's good. That's bodhisattvas do that. But they don't try to get something back for themselves. So if you're trying to get something back for yourself, say, well, this is good that I'm helping my child, but I'm not doing bodhisattva practice. But I'm aware that I'm not. And if you're aware you're not, then you can be kind to that you're not. And if you're kind to that you're not, you'll stop acting in this non-bodhisattva way. You'll start giving to your children. Even though you like, it's fine to like, it's good that they appreciate you. So wanting them to appreciate you is not a bad thing. But to try to get appreciation, that is evil. It's evil to try to get people to appreciate you. It's evil to try to get people to like you. That's evil. But the main person that hurts is yourself. And if you hurt yourself that way, you're going to hurt others. To want people to like you is okay. Because it's good for them to like you. To want people to appreciate you, to want people to be kind to you, that's good. But to try to get it is evil. And if you if you make gifts to people and don't try to get anything from them, you're going to get more appreciation, probably, than if you try to get appreciation. I can't say for sure, but you'll get a lot of appreciation anyway. If you give gifts without any expectation, without trying to get something, you will get tremendous appreciation. But if you do it to try to get it, you still may get some appreciation, but you'll also get tremendous misery. And you'll be setting a bad example for your children. So, I know it's difficult, but it's more important to teach your children giving than to give them food. Because if you don't give them food, they can get food from somebody else. You know, they'll find a way to get food. But who's going to teach them giving if you don't? Because you're right there. You know? And sometimes you have no food for your children, but you can still be generous. That's the most important thing for the parents to give the children is compassion. And just to feed them, to try to get them fed even, that's the reason for feeding them, just to get the food down their throat. That's not compassion. Compassion is to give with no expectation. That's what these children have come into the world to learn. And it's possible to give them dinner without expectation, and then they get fed, plus they get taught compassion. But if you have no food, you can still teach them compassion. If you have food, you can learn to give it to them without expecting that they'll eat it, that they'll say thank you, that they'll think you're a good father, or that it'll even stay down in their stomach. You look like this is a little hard for you to understand.
Oh, I think I need to think about it some more.
Yeah, please do. And I will too. Thank you very much for your honesty. Well, it's almost 6 o'clock, so let's have a ball living for the welfare of the world. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha.